Champagne Sharks, episode 18. This is T, also known on Twitter as Ricky Rawls. That's RickyRawls. And this episode is reader questions. So, as anyone who's listened to the show already knows, on the website Curious Cat, I like to take different questions and let people ask whatever's on their mind. Some of them I answer immediately. The ones that are particularly good, I save for the show. So, here's what we have so far. Okay. Pulling it up. Should have had it ready. But hey. Okay, here we go. What's good? What do you think of films like the Madea series by Tyler Perry? Or films by the Wayans brothers? Films which Spike Lee referred to as coonery buffoonery. Now, this is kind of a tough one because, okay, Tyler Perry, to me, on a craft level, is not that great. I mean, his stuff, he has about 5 plot lines that he repeats ad nauseum. I mean, it's always the same thing. Somebody's on crack. There's always some old head with some wisdom trying to hip the young head to God and, you know, not chasing that fast life or that fast dollar or that fast sex. And the young person doesn't want to listen and just wants to, live that life and be ratchet or whatever. I mean, it's always the same storyline. There's always a good guy, a good hardworking brother who has a steady job, but it's not a glamorous job. And somebody's always getting seduced by something fast. The fast high, the fast nightlife, you know. And the person will chase the bad person, you know, the bad slick guy, to her downfall, because usually a woman. And then one of two things happens. She either realizes her ways and chooses the good man, or she gets AIDS and a drug addiction, maybe a baby, and falls down the tubes while the good man goes on and prospers. It's a pretty tired morality tale, and it's the same one over and over again. And the jokes aren't particularly good. The plots aren't particularly good, but I mean, they're kind of engaging. I've up until a certain point, I'd watched every Tyler Perry movie. I probably watched at least a dozen. How many are there? I watched a lot. I had also seen all the stage plays, which would probably surprise a lot of people. I've seen up until 5 years ago. I had seen every stage play in every movie he did until 5 years ago. And you might wonder, despite how mediocre I said his stuff is, why did I do that? And my take on it is, white people support their own mediocre stuff all the time. And if we want to be honest, black people support a lot of white mediocre stuff a lot too, if enough white people support that white mediocre thing. So one of my takes is, hey, his stuff could be a lot better. I wish his craft was a lot better, but I mean, I watch a lot of these things that white people put extras on, like say the movie Little Miss Sunshine, you know, or just what other things have I seen in the white world get a lot of shine that I watch and I'm like, huh? Like Girls, like I tried like 2 seasons of that. Then to be fair, I don't even think a lot of white people really like Girls. I think it was just critics because the ratings were never good on that, to be honest. It was just, its target audience was just disproportionately represented in the media. So that's not a good example. But in general, there's just a lot of things that I see Like, for example, a lot of Judd Apatow movies. Like, I watched them. Like, okay, this is the same thing over and over again. Just like Tyler Perry is the same thing over again. It's some slacker with an improbably hot girlfriend. He smokes a lot of weed. His friends are dicks. He's a dick. He smokes more weed. He's just kind of unlikable the whole time. And, you know, he gets his happy ending with his hot girlfriend or hot wife. Total overgrown adolescent white guy kind of frat bro fantasy. Yeah. And they seem to do pretty well. So, I mean, my take on it is, okay. To me, Tyler Perry, I'm not crazy about him. If people want to watch him, like, so be it. Because here's one thing I'll say in Tyler Perry's favor. And it's something that I will always admire in a black person. He is a black person with a real black constituency. And what I mean by that is, he's not really chosen by white people and then he becomes popular. He became popular and then white people had to get on board with him because there was too much money to be missed out on by not getting on board with him. You see what I mean? Like, most of the icons in the black community that have mainstream recognition that are household names, a lot of times they've been chosen by white people, not by black people. Yeah, like, a lot of our academics turned pundits, a lot of our talking head personalities, etc. We used to have a time where we used to choose a lot of our own celebrities. Like, say, for example, in the 90s, you take something like Fox Thursday Nights. You had Martin, Living Single, what's it called? New York Undercover. I mean, these were shows that seemed to be made for the black gaze, you know, G-A-Z-E. These were shows that seemed to be about, okay, we want black people to watch this show. We're not worried about interpreting it every step of the way to make sure that white people can keep up. This is just shows that are made with black people in mind first and foremost. And that's the concern. And those shows used to be great. I mean, they had lots of slang. They had lots of topics that black people cared about. They had a lot of hip-hop references. And if you compare it to a show like Black-ish, for example, Black-ish has black people in mind too, but it also keeps white people in mind every step of the way as well. Every step of the way. I mean, Black-ish is always explaining black people. And a lot of these new black shows always, for example, the Carmichael show is another one. Carmichael show is a good show, but you can tell they're always trying to make sure that white people who watch can keep up. Whereas those shows like Martin, Living Single, the UPN shows, you know, like Half and Half, One on One, Moesha, however many there were a ton of them. They all had names like All of Us, One on One. On CW, you had like the Wayans Brothers, you had all those things. Like, the Wayans Brothers used to, like, all those shows would have Easter eggs that were like hip-hop Easter eggs or black culture Easter eggs. Things where, like, if you didn't know, say, Brand Nubian or 90s Tribe Called Quest or Death Certificate Ice Cube, you might miss a lot of the jokes because a lot of the jokes would be references on, you know, 90s hip-hop, gangster rap, boom-bap hip-hop. It was high-context stuff. Like, high-context meaning, like, you had to be kind of steeped in urban culture to get the most out of it. Whereas a lot of these new black shows are low-context. You can come in without a lot of pre-existing context and just kind of get in right away. They're meant to have a very broad appeal. And Tyler Perry, to me, is, oh, let me back up a little bit. A lot of movies were like that, too. I remember in the 90s, there were a slew of black-targeted movies. a ton. And they used to come out, they wouldn't do great business, but they would make a profit. I mean, obviously, because they just kept making them. And I remember they used to always have a hot soundtrack with each new black movie, and people used to collect the soundtracks. An example is, say, something like Woo with Jada Pinkett and Tommy Davidson. That's one example, but there were a ton of movies like that. Belly, that's another one. Like, we had a lot of these kind of black movies that were made with black people in mind, were very high context, and they were popular with us, you know? They would never count as a hit in the mainstream society, but I don't think they even really were intending to. I mean, their attitude was, as long as black people get it and watch it and we can make a profit, that's good. And if white people find something that they enjoy in all this, that's a bonus. You know, that's not our be all end all, but we'll take it. It's a bonus. That's how I remember it. And that's kind of dead now. You know, now it's very different. Now I feel like everything's meant to be broad. You have to be sure that you're appealing to white people at every step of the way. Tyler Perry, even though I don't like his level of craft, he has a black constituency. And I mean, like, he is grassroots in his appeal. It wasn't like somebody picked him from obscurity, some white person, gave him a shot, and then, you know, he blew up and black people across the country found him like that. He really grew his appeal on that stage circuit, that black stage circuit. He just wrote his plays, he grinded it out, and he built a base. And what I like about Tyler Perry is he writes and directs for a type of black person who's often neglected. So you take your, like, say something like Boys in the Hood. Boys in the Hood is good, but that's something that you could tell it was really made to keep white liberals in the loop as well. You see what I mean? Like, I'm not saying it was primarily made for them or it wasn't made for black people. I believe that was probably very made for black people as well, but you can tell by how it's staged, by how it's the gazes, that, you know, they want to make sure that white liberals notice the movie and that it doesn't lose them, right? And a lot of black movies are like that. A lot of black movies are done to make sure that middle-class blacks aren't embarrassed. Because we don't really talk about classism in the black community enough, but just like how white people have, you know, that redneck cousin that they're embarrassed of or whatever, a lot of black people, especially upwardly mobile black people trying to enter the middle class or enter the upper middle class or get out of the middle class altogether, a lot of them are very, very conscious about the images of black people that white people see, especially the kind of white people they have to work with and rub shoulders with and live with in their majority white neighborhoods, and that their kids have to go to school with in their majority white schools. And these people get extra, extra embarrassed at what they consider ghetto black people or blue or just blue collar black people. Like, you don't even have to be all the way ghetto. You just have to be a little, I think, is the word they class A? I forget, but just a little rough around the edges, right? So I believe that's kind of what Spike Lee, in my opinion, has going on with Tyler Perry. Because, okay, you call him a coon and all that. I don't think Tyler Perry's a coon. I don't think he's a coon. Because this is, first you have to understand what a coon is. A coon is somebody who makes fun of black people, who makes a mockery of black people, who plays up black stereotypes, but primarily for the purpose of impressing white people or entertaining white people. Coon is not really about class. You can be very highly educated and rich and highly credentialed and still be a coon. You know, you can be an intellectual coon. You can, like, for example, Adolf Reed wrote that critique of black public intellectuals, right? And it's called What Are the Drums Saying, Booker? It's something I always recommend. It's a great starting point if you want to understand black media discourse and the black media academic industrial complex. But if you read that, he talks about how a lot of these pundits and public intellectuals are doing all their academic stuff, all their things with white people in mind. They don't even have a real black constituency. They don't have a real black following, you know? Any black following they do have is usually other middle class black bougie people, academics, intellectuals, professionals who have discovered that black person through white people's endorsement. You see what I'm saying? So white people endorsed him and a lot of other black people found him, you know? So, okay. You can be, in this paper, he talks about how a lot of these black public intellectuals like to code switch. Like, they'll speak intellectual in the paper and then drop some slang or drop a rap lyric or drop something to kind of, you know, entertain the white people with their authenticity, you know? So they might mention that they have a book coming out and they'll announce that the book's coming out and couple it with like a black saying or something performative. Like, you know, they'll switch between sounding highbrow and then doing something, peppering it with some Ebonics or something that they think will make them seem authentic. And that's not done for black people. That's done to entertain white, usually liberals. That's that intellectual cooning. That person is not ghetto. That person is not lowbrow, but they're a coon. I don't think Tyler Perry's a coon, because I think Tyler Perry loves black people. A coon hates black people and spreads stereotypes or does things to reinforce stereotypes to entertain white people. So they will denigrate black people or spread stereotypical images of black people for the entertainment of white people. Whereas Tyler Perry, I think, writes for black people. He came up doing those plays, and you can buy DVD versions of those plays. Like, you know, they filmed live stagings of them. And when you look in the audience is all black. And these aren't like bougie, high-fluting black people. These are, a lot of times in these audiences, they're country, they're blue collar. You have like the church folk, they're people with finger waves in their hair, and you know, the kind of people that would horrify people, the black people at Martha's Vineyard, or, you know, the black people in Jack and Jill or the Boule, which are like kind of high level black social organizations or social clubs. It's, and I think that's really more where Spike is coming from. And I don't think it's fair to call Tyler Perry coon, because he's done nothing that shows me that he hates black people to me. You know, he doesn't always do the optimal thing, but sometimes he does things where I'm like, I wish you didn't do that. Like, some of the labor practices that they said he was doing at, you know, his studio in Atlanta. You know, I was like, you should be a little better to your black employees than that. It's some labor issue, but that doesn't mean he hates black people. And he was doing none of that to me to entertain or please white people. So I don't think he's a coon. But something else that I like about Tyler Perry, right? I try to watch Seinfeld and shows like that, and those shows are Two Broke Girls is another one. Like, they always have minorities appear, and they appear through that white gaze, that white, I might be mispronouncing the word, but there's a word called solipsism. And solipsism is when a person believes that when people are out of their sight, like they cease to exist, as if the person, as if like they kind of give people life or make people matter, as if people aren't as human, as real as you, that they're just kind of like supporting characters who walk in and out of your life, and once they're not in your life, they almost kind of disappear. Yeah, it's like you think you're the only mind which exists, or your mental states are the only mental states. And a lot of white people, especially in the upper classes, kind of walk around like this. And you see it in their media, like foreign people are just a stereotype or a funny accent or a funny name or, you know, something like that. And when you watch Seinfeld, that's what you see. Like the Asian people are just people in nail salons who just are just walking, talking stereotypes. The Puerto Rican people are just kind of like, their mental state is like childlike, and they're just giant stereotypes waving flags around and eating beans and rice. Like on Seinfeld, everything's a stereotype. Same thing with Two Broke Girls. Everyone kind of exists as a stereotype for, they almost exist for the white people to comment on or react to or laugh about. And what I like about Tyler Perry is that he does to white people in his movies what they traditionally do to black people and other minorities. They just exist kind of in the background or for the black people to play off of, or to just be a stereotype. Like they'll come on and just do something really uptight, like, excuse me, miss, can you keep your voice down? You know, and that is like the flip side of like an all-white movie, and then the only black person you see in that movie is when they need somebody to be sassy in customer service. So then, like, you know, the white customer is trying, the white main character is trying to get his car out of the parking garage. And then there's some, you know, big mammy type customer service lady. And she's just there like, you're not getting your car, you know. And she's just there just to be like a stereotype for them to laugh at. Because that's all she exists at to them. She's not anything outside of that desk. She just came into existence when that white person came to get their car and they needed her. And then once they're gone from that situation, she just stops existing. You don't care about what her home life is. You don't care about her family or whatever. She's just the person that got in the way of your car. And you don't even care to know more about her because she's almost like an extension of you. That's what narcissists do. They turn other people into extensions of them instead of recognizing them as equally valid, equally whole other people who are as separate, as unique, as autonomous, and have as much of a mind as you do. And this one thing that really fascinates me about Tyler Perry is how he reverses it. Another movie I did this was the movie Boomerang. And a lot of people, white people hated that movie too. But yeah, that's what fascinates me about Tyler Perry, is how he does that. Like, he puts the movies in Atlanta, everyone's black. Everyone who's a character is black most of the time. And then, yeah, the white people are just there to be stereotypes, to be comic relief, to be extensions of the black people, or they don't really exist except when the black people are kind of interacting with them at a restaurant. And a lot of times the white people are kind of serving them. If you look at his movies, it happens a lot. They're either doing something that's kind of rude or obnoxious, or they're just service characters. He's changed this lately. Like in recent years, he's kind of had multiracial dramas and comedies, and he's even recently done an all-white show. But for a long time, he was doing that. And part of me used to always think, hey, I wonder if that's one of the reasons why a lot of white people don't like him. Because, I mean, yeah, his craft isn't great, but there's a lot of people whose craft aren't great that they don't get like that viscerally like disgusted with. And also because bougie black people are always worried about what their white friends and coworkers and peers think of them, and therefore are worried about what they think about other black people, because what they think about other black people might end up negatively affecting what those white friends think of them. I think a lot of bougie black people get as offended by Tyler Perry's minimization of white people as some of the white people. That's my personal take on it. So, I mean, Tyler Perry has a real black constituency, a real black following, kind of like how a lot of, like I'll give an example. Like MTV News has a show called Decoded, and they have this girl on it, I forget, oh, Francesca Ramsey, and I've been seeing her all around like the past 2 years or so, and she's been getting pretty popular, talking about race. You have a lot of other people too in the black media who are talking heads on every single show, but I don't really know a lot of black people, especially like a lot of blue collar black people in the street who really fuck with them like that, you know? Yeah, like I don't really, if I go to a lot of my black friends' house and I tell them, hey, you heard of Francesca Ramsey? They're gonna be like, who's that? But if I talk to like a lot of white people, they're like, oh yeah, that's that girl, you know? Or bougie black people or black media nerds like me, because, you know, I tend to be a media nerd, like I tend to know a lot of these people. I'm very into media, but yeah, for those who are not, like a lot of black people don't know them yet. Someone like, say, Umar Johnson, right? He can raise a lot of money just off of black people without white people, you know? Take someone like Tariq Nasheed. A lot of bougie blue check black media people don't really like him, but he has a strong black following. He can get like 5-6 movies crowdfunded just off of black people, and black people will ride for him hard of all different types of walks of life. Whereas a lot of the white approved, white chosen, white promoted, white picked black media figures, they get their money from, you know, big prestige media. If NPR shuts down their podcast or their show, they're pretty much done. Or they'll have to try to crowdfund from their mostly white liberal, you know, base. Like, you know, like no shade, but that guy, Gene Demby at NPR, I don't really know a lot of black people from, except for like bougie black people who know a lot of white liberals, who really know Gene Demby. Like, you know, if I go to a cookout or something, I'm like, hey, you read that Gene Demby piece? They'll be like, huh? But if I say, hey, did you see Breakfast Club? Or did you hear what happened with Dr. Umar Johnson on this show? Or, hey, do you... You know, Breakfast Club is Charlamagne the God. Like, Charlamagne the God is very popular in the black community. He has a very strong black constituency, you know? Tyler Perry has that. And I always admire somebody who has that, because on some level, they are really tapped into their people. And that's something that I always try to aim for myself. I'm very conscious about that. Like, are black people digging my message? Like, I don't want to be primarily white people's favorite black person. Not any shade against white people. You know, Not at all. I enjoy discourse with anyone. I enjoy having anyone as a fan. But if you have that black constituency, you're naturally incentivized to be accountable to black people. It gets harder to throw black people under the bus. And that's the type of thing that I want to keep me honest. So they're connected somehow, and you have to appreciate that. If you have that constituency, I'm always going to give you a little bit of a benefit of the doubt. So, same thing with the Wayans brothers, because that was another part of the question, and I don't think that they're coons either. Because the Wayans, that whole family, was made big by black. Like, we loved In Living Color in the 90s, and we fucked with it heavy. So, yeah, I mean, if you look at something like the Drew Carey Show, and they had that character Mimi, and I remember Monique made this point once, because there were a lot of middle-class bougie black people kind of getting on her about her show, The Parkers. That's another example of a show that was big in the black community, made for the black gays, was not really concerned with winning over white people. And like Tyler Perry stuff, it reversed a lot of the stereotypes. Like, for example, they had a token, but the token was a white girl. And she was just basically exactly like the black tokens that you see on white shows. Like, you know, the black sassy best friend. You know, they reversed it. They did that. And Monique made a good point. She's like, all these fancy, snobby black people always trying to hold me down and, you know, call me like a coon and this and that because my character, you know, is a little buffoonish. But, you know, that white lady who plays Mimi on the Drew Carey Show, you know, she has makeup on like a clown and has ill-fitting dress and does all this stuff. And she's getting Emmys and she's being praised for a comedic genius. And where's the fairness in that? And I say, you know what? She kind of has a point. And again, black people fuck with her. So to me, she's doing something right on some level. So the final thing I'll say about that is I think Spike Lee, because this is the thing about Spike Lee. He tries to have it kind of both ways. He wants to be like, you know, hey, I'm the Brooklyn guy. I'm this and that. I stay to my roots and all that. But he's always on Martha's Vineyard and stuff like that. And one time I saw him tell a story, he's like, oh, yeah, when I go around Martha's Vineyard, like, all my neighbors are scandalized. I come around driving, blasting my music loud, and I'll be there in my Yankees hat, and they'll be like, oh, look at this guy, he's coming down. He's kind of trying to make it seem like, oh, yeah, everywhere I go, I keep it real. But come on, dude, you have kind of aspirational ways to be upper class. You're on Martha's Vineyard for a reason. You put on the Yankees hat and you turn it to the side and you blast your Jay-Z real loud or your whatever other dad rap you have that really is already out of touch with what black people in the street are listening to. And you do all this stuff so that you can feel okay being aspirational. You know, see what I'm saying? I'm not putting down being aspirational or wanting to be middle class. If you want to be on Martha's Vineyard, if you want to rub shoulders with the black bourgeoisie, if you want to marry, because he also married into that. His wife is, even though he might be more famous in the mainstream because he's a celebrity, his wife is actually higher social status in the black community, if you understand how social status works, as far as like her family is from a distinguished black background, a black pedigree. If there's a good book to read about black high society called Our Kind of People. I forget the guy's name. I think it's Lawrence Harvey. But yeah, it's a pretty good book. But they told stories and stuff. I've read interviews, and you know, it was basically a question about is. The question was about whether he was good enough for her, not vice versa. Like, a lot of people in her family, when they tell the story, were like, are you sure you want to marry this guy and stuff like that? So, So yeah, he wasn't marrying like around the way girl. And that's not to throw any shade on him or his marriage or his wife or anything, but I feel like when he was putting down Tyler Perry, a lot of that was a put down to kind of show out for white people in a way. Because he wanted white people to know, hey, this guy with his blue collar, loud ways, like, you know, this black version of a redneck, I want to publicly make a show of distancing myself from that so that you know what I want to reaffirm. It's like the old Chris Rock black people versus nigger skit. And it's a routine that I hate, but it's a kind of mindset that a lot of black people who are aspirational, middle class or upper class have to believe that they can transcend niggerdom by being rich and having civility and having manners and being educated. And they hate anything that reminds them or white people of black stereotypes. And they try to convince themselves that being a nigger is being that. They tell them, because the truth is, in white society, being a nigger is just being black and living under a system of white supremacy. That's how it works in white supremacy. That's all you have to do to be a nigger. These people, to get by in the world and to be at peace, they convince themselves that being a nigger is being ghetto, being low class, being poor, being rude, being loud, being coarse, being a bore. Bore as in B-O-O-R, being boorish. Being a drug addict, being homeless, being blue collar, you know, they try to tell themselves that is what they try to project nigger them into that and to encase it in that and just say, as long as I react against that and push off from that and I do it in a very public way so that white people can see, I'm reaffirming my not nigger them. I'm reaffirming that I'm transcending nigger them. So I feel like that's what a lot of that was about. And what I don't like about that the most is, look, if you think he's a coon, if you think he has these ways, pull his coattails. Talk to him. Say, hey, look, man, I've been in this game a long time. I can help you a lot. Like, why don't you talk to him behind the scenes and help that brother out? Help him write better. Help him direct better. Show him something. Instead of trying to down him to impress bougie black people and white people, like, you know, that's something you're doing. From when I read the interviews about his wife's family and stuff, see, that's a move that impresses white family, his wife's family. Like, see, like, okay, so you performatively drive down Martha's Vineyard, you know, in your super expensive car with your Yankees hat and your Knicks jersey, and you're blasting Jay-Z, and you think you're some kind of, you know, rebel against your new class. But that's just performative. When it's time to substantively help somebody who's really, you know, from certain roots, you're downing him to impress people. Like, you'd impress me more if he just drove a nice car and wore a suit in Martha's Vineyard and drank with your pinkies out, you know, in a white crushed linen suit on the beach in Martha's Vineyard or the Hamptons. But when it's time to speak ill publicly in mixed company of a black guy with a black constituency like Tyler Perry, you don't do it. You don't throw him under the bus and you help him out. That would impress me more as far as an act of rebellion against those snobby black people on Martha's Vineyard. You know, rubbing shoulders publicly with Tyler Perry and supporting him would be a way more shocking statement to make to those black snobs that you claim to be thumbing your nose at than all that Yankees hat to the side stuff. That's my take on that. And okay, what other questions do we have here? I'd love to hear you talk about the legacy of Malcolm X and what you think it meant and still means today. I'd also be fascinated to hear your take on Louis Farrakhan. My knowledge about him is quite minimal, but I know he's a controversial figure. I wonder what you think of him and if your opinion of him has changed over the years. Could you expand on your views towards the film Moonlight and your reservations about it? Okay. Malcolm X. I'm a big fan of Malcolm X, but if you want to ask me how my views changed about him, my old views were different on him because my old views on Malcolm X I got from middle class black people and from white mainstream society and the white educational system, meaning that my biggest takeaway from Malcolm X used to be that he was very radical and he hated white people, but he was just misguided and his heart was in the right place, and that his real notable thing was that he eventually saw past hating white people and embraced them, and he transcended being pro-black toward being pro, you know, just being a humanist. And first, as I started really researching Malcolm and started really reading stuff on him, like reading and rereading his stuff, and started reading third-party things about him, and also started reading a lot of his speeches and interviews and watching them. YouTube has been very great. I have watched so many speeches on YouTube, and I kind of have doubts about Alex Haley's account. I feel like Alex Haley, because Malcolm X was dead by the time the book came out. And you read the book and there's a big change in, you know, tone or whatever. And I really do believe that he did soften a lot of his stances, but I don't believe that his edge was taken off as much as we like to be shown. Like, we're shown like he just became a giant teddy bear. I'm not really sure. Like, first off, I don't think he really hated white people before his Mecca moment as portrayed. And I don't think he fell in love with them as much after as is portrayed. I think both are kind of exaggerated, because if you do a lot of research, I mean, he's seemed to get along and enjoy the attention of white society a lot. He was on all these shows. He did speeches here. I mean, he talked very harshly and brutally, but I mean, some people might say that about me. I mean, there's friends of mine who I tell about this podcast and my views and the show, and they're like, white people listen to that? And I'm like, they seem to really like it. And they can't wrap their heads around it, you know? And they'll think, wow, you talk pretty brutally honest sometimes. And I'm like, but I think white people, intellectuals, especially leftists, radicals, they have a type of curiosity to them. They'll keep coming back. And if you look at the old Black Power clips, you look at Stokely Carmichael, and you look at all those white radical students in the audience, just enraptured. You look at Fred Hampton and Black Panther speeches. You look at Malcolm's crowd. You look at where Malcolm was. I mean, he was harsh. He was brutally honest, but he was open to discourse. And he seemed, a lot of times, especially when he let his guard down, he seemed to really enjoy it. If anything, I would think he actually low-key was getting seduced by the white attention, by the white validation. For a while, long before he went to Mecca, I think the celebrity did kind of go to his head, and I wouldn't be surprised if It was an example of white people weaponizing their attention and flattery and validation. And if how much of that might have planted the seeds, he might have thought that Mecca was where he did this cognitive snap, this shift. But that seed might have been planted by all the fawning adulation and attention and celebrity he was given by white people for years before then. Like, that might have just been the final push he needed. One thing looking back at Malcolm that I will criticize him on, and I think he realized this too, he got way too into putting down other black people for the attention, for the entertainment of white people. And it's something that I struggle with myself, because to a degree I probably fall into that trap, because his targets were the same ones that my targets tend to be, which is this black misleadership class, this black professional managerial class that you know, it's kind of primarily beholden to white liberals. And like, his critiques, see, here's the thing, his critiques were on point, which is what I tried to do. I tried to critique that class as incisively as possible, but he went a little too far into the name calling, which is where I think he gets kind of toxic and starts hurting your cause. Because at the end of the day, you want to connect with other black people. And I will say, anybody, any black bougie blue check type people, if they wanted to seriously work against white supremacy with me, and they showed that they were serious, I would put aside anything I had with them and do it. Like, that matters to me more than any particular grudge or dislike of their politics that I would have. Whereas, I don't think the reverse is always true. But he started realizing that in his life. And when you read a lot of his interviews or read his accounts, you know, in the book, in the autobiography, I think he kind of says it too. Like, he kind of wants to start mending bridges. I think especially because he got disillusioned with Elijah Muhammad. And he also realized that by alienating all these people, when he lost Elijah Muhammad, he was by himself because he built no other bridges. He kind of made himself an island and put all his chips in one basket. And I think he kind of regretted with maturity as he got older all that he had kind of done to and there's a scene in Selma that from what I'm told was a true scene. There's a scene in Selma where he's kind of reaching out to Coretta Scott King, and he's kind of apologizing, and she's saying that he said all these nasty things about him, and he's like, you know, he kind of realizes he was wrong. And this is like kind of later. He's, and a lot has happened to change him. And yeah, that's, I mean, I could go on and on about Malcolm X, because I read a lot about him, and I'm reading a book about him right now, actually. It's written by a Marxist socialist. It's called, his name is Wolfenstein, and the book is called, that I'm reading now, The Victims of Democracy, Malcolm X and the Black Revolution by Eugene Victor Wolfenstein. But that one is pretty good too. But yeah, I'm always reading about him. I can go on forever. I will stop it there. Last, you asked about Louis Farrakhan. I like Louis Farrakhan for the same reason I like Malcolm X, for the same reason I like the Wayans brothers, for the same reason I like Tyler Perry. He has a black constituency. So that means that he's connecting on some level. And once you do that, I will never totally dismiss you, because it's something you can teach me. And I was a fan of Louis Farrakhan. I went to the Million Man March. It remains one of the most poignant memories that I have. I don't know enough about him the way I do about Malcolm X to really speak on him with authority. But to this day, I saw him do a Breakfast Club interview, and he's still sharp. I like how he challenges white supremacy. I like how he articulates himself. There's a classic scene. I'm going to end the show with it, but it's a classic scene where he's talking to Mike Wallace at 60 Minutes. And when you see it, I mean, it's just classic Farrakhan, and he just, oh, you know something? I'm not even going to tell you. I will just end the show with it later on. But yeah, I really, I don't fully get what his activities are to improve the black community these days. I'm not 100% sure. So because of that, I can't fully endorse him or critique him. Like, you know, I have to know what he's doing behind the scenes, but I do like that he's kept his integrity. Some of his anti-Semitism, from what I've heard of it, I haven't been crazy about it. I feel like it's a distraction. I don't know why he goes there. It's a trap that happens a lot that I think just diverts from more important things, which is dismantling the system of white supremacy as a whole. I have no interest in anti-Semitism. I don't think it's something worth entertaining or indulging. And some of the things that he said go a little toward that category. And I mean, I've only heard like two or three negative quotes, but I'm sure he's done more. Because like I said, I haven't been like a super fan of Louis Farrakhan. What I know of him is more very casual. Okay, now the film Moonlight, and oh, nice, we're still under an hour, so I have time to fit this in. Okay, the film Moonlight. Now, this is something, maybe I should do a whole separate show about this and save this for another time, because I can go on about it for a while, but okay. Conservative racism is something that worries me, but it doesn't worry me as much as liberal racism in many ways, because conservative racism, like, people see it coming, and it's a little more honest. So when it happens, it's more brutal in the short term, but you see it coming, you can fight against it. Black people are more likely to mobilize against it. You know, black people don't care about the approval of white conservatives so much, and they, you know, openly dislike them too, and they will fight with them, and they have such clarity to be able to see their enemy when it's a conservative. And plus, the white conservative doesn't really care so much about making sure that the black person thinks that they're good. So, for example, I mean, the closest I saw to them caring was during that neoconservative, compassionate conservative Bush era. You remember they were trying to just kind of use some of mainstream liberals' tools against them. He stacked his cabinet with some black people and some women, and particularly like black women like Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell and some other people, and they were saying, oh, look, see, you liberals are about diversity, but why is his cabinet more diverse than Bill Clinton's was, you know? And little things like that. There was a stage where they were trying to kind of play that role a little bit, but that was a short time. I mean, post-Obama, they went right to just not caring anymore. And now with Trump, it's like at an all-time high of not caring what black people think. Is they're just throwing black people under the bus right in the front. He just has a totally white cabinet, except for like maybe Ben Carson, and yeah, he's just very naked about it. But what makes white liberal racism dangerous is that first, it's always mutating. It's always finding new ways, you know, like they'll be like, oh, tell me how to check my privilege. And then like black people, well, certain type of black person who takes it as his job to educate white people will be like, oh, this is how you did a microaggression, and this is how you have to check your privilege. And then that white person will adjust behaviorally to not flaunt his privilege. He'll check his privilege. He'll check his tone. He'll check his how his words. He won't use, you know, the wrong trigger words, and he'll do all this behavioral optics stuff, but he's not dismantling the system of white supremacy. He's just trying to be more tasteful under that system. And on the flip side, unlike with the conservative, who the black person, you know, vehemently dislikes, the most black people are very seduced by white liberals and want their approval and want to believe that they're just basically white liberals and blackface themselves. They want to believe that they're just white people. They want to believe they were just white liberals who were just left in the oven a little too long and seasoned with a little extra spiciness and Lori seasoned salt and some cayenne. Like, you know, they see themselves almost just like white middle class liberals with just like a little kick, you know? They're very into that whole post racial thinking. They're just like their white peers, their friends. Especially as long as the white person is not reminding them that they're black and that they're second class because they're black, that person to them is not really doing anything racist. They're not doing any slurs. You know, it's kind of like how Bill Maher, a lot of black people were fine with him. Then when he said that slur and he said nigger, then they lost it. Because he was now doing that kind of conservative, that kind of racism they associate with conservatives. So going back to, this adaptability of liberal racism and this way that it mutates and this way that, you know, when you tell it something, it's always changing and adapting because it's always trying to seduce black intellectuals, combined with this black willingness to be seduced by white liberals. This, you know, they want the message communicated from these white liberals that you're one of us, right? Those two things combined to me make liberal racism so much more dangerous, because it can get away with more. It's smarter. It's harder to kill. It's constantly evolving, and a lot of black people are suckers for it. So going to Moonlight, right? You had this big thing for a while among the Wokerati. I call them the Wokerati, like the celebrated black woke people. Among the black Wokerati, the celebrated black woke people, there was a constant stream of think pieces for years about the white savior complex. We're sick of the white savior. We're sick of the white savior. And because everything is optics and knee-jerk stuff, people just start saying, hey, there's a white savior in this. Bad. White savior in this. Bad. And just people don't really think with nuance. People don't really think about effects, about what the substantive effect of things are. Because if something has the same effect as something else, then it doesn't really matter how you dress it up or if it checks off all these little boxes. At the end of the day, you're in the same place. Now, what happens with things like Moonlight is the same thing that happens with something like Precious. White liberals, the same ones that pissed off a lot of their black peers with this white savior thing, managed to repackage the white savior thing as what I call the black non-savior. See, and what it is it's the flip side. I wish I knew the word. Is it converse? Is it inverse? I don't know. But it's the flip side of what happens on the other side of the coin of the white savior trope. And what I mean by that is, okay, if the white savior trope says that white saviors are needed in order for any black people to lift themselves out of their squalor, that if the white savior trope, if the problem with it is that it denies black people of agency, of the ability to formulate their own visions and to have the discipline to enact those visions, to empower themselves and to gain themselves any semblance of freedom or autonomy or ability or willingness to strike against the system of white supremacy. If the white savior denies the black people of any of that, of any role in bettering their lives or fighting against oppression, right? Then what happens to those black people when the white savior is gone? They won't be able to do anything. They're just going to sit there hopelessly and just revel in the squalor. Because the kind of black person that needs a white savior is the kind of black person who can't save themselves. That's the black non-savior. So white savior movies only work with black non-saviors. If the black person is capable, smart enough, self-directed enough, has enough agency enough to save himself, then it's not a white savior movie anymore. Even if the white savior is there, he's kind of minimized, you know? It's not quite the same. If the black person is as capable of saving or more capable of saving than the white person, then in that point, you're not a white savior. You're at best maybe a white sidekick or a white partner. You know, you're not a true white savior. A true white savior is like Dangerous Minds or, you know, a host of other movies where there's just nothing happening unless the white person helps the other person. You know, the Blind Side, etc. That guy was, if picture The Blind Side with Sandra Bullock, if you took the white characters out of it, what would happen to that kid? What would be his life? What would that movie be? That character, that kid, it would have just been Precious. And Precious, if a white savior at any point in that movie came in and saved her, that movie would have turned into The Blind Side. So if you think about it, it's the same thing. It's the same worldview in movies like Precious and Moonlight and in movies like The Blind Side and Dangerous Minds and those movies. They're in the same movie. Moonlight and all those other movies, these movies that these black coffee creamers are celebrating so hard. These white liberals are just so fucking slick. They just gave them back the white savior movie. They gave them that same movie and just repackaged it and tricked them into thinking it's empowerment. And these dumbasses fell for it. They always fall for it because they just want to be accepted by them so bad. You know, it's no coincidence that these same people who fell in love with Moonlight are the same ones who think the biggest problem black people face is where the white people give them Oscars. You know, who if you ask them what's the biggest piece of advancement that you black wokerati have done? I mean, what have you accomplished in these past couple of years of constant think pieces and protests? You know, they always say, well, we got Oscars so white. We got them Oscars. Like, our outrage got, you know, the white academy to give these black people Oscars. Like, you know, it's no coincidence that these same people who are gullible enough to believe that a bunch of token Oscars that they were given, what token shiny trinkets they were given just to shut them up, actually means anything. That's how badly they want to believe that white liberals love them and that, you know, they're friends with them. It's no surprise these same people are the ones gullible enough to believe that this is that Moonlight and the movies like that are some negation of the white savior trope, just because the white savior isn't actually on screen. It reinforces the white savior thing, because when you watch it, right, the white savior is almost implicit, like unspoken, unconscious throughout it. Because when you're just watching in Moonlight, all these black people just living in squalor, dysfunctional, they can't get along. It just looks like the black community just looks like a terrible place where all they do is terrorize each other. You know, at some point, you just keep thinking, like, man, somebody needs to save him. And it doesn't look like black people can do it. They're all a mess. They're all just trying to survive themselves. You know, it's that brutish social world that Thomas Hobbes talked about in Leviathan. It's like nasty life is nasty, brutish, and short. And, you know, there's a total lack of humanity here. It's disgusting. And I think that's why white liberals love it so much, because I'm sure when a white liberal watches it, what do they think? Oh, it's too bad it's a white person has to come in there and save them. It still reinforces that white savior trope. Like, whenever you see a black movie that really shows that black people don't need saviors, liberals don't like it that much. They will find a reason to have a problem with it, you know? And the closest I've seen someone to subvert that is Jordan Peele in Get Out. Like, and I think he just made that movie just too good, too entertaining, and too coded for them to really get it. Like, you know, he, I think he kind of pulled a fast one on them, whereas Nate Parker's Birth of a Nation, it was a little too obvious about fuck a white savior, we're going to empower ourselves, and I feel like he got very sabotaged. So yeah, like, I mean, it's just like a big joke. That crowd, that black woke karate crowd, they always fall for it. Kind of like how they were sick of magical Negroes and stuff, but, you know, if you repackage the magical Negro male as the black girl magic, you know, superwoman, you know, like Beyonce is going to save the world and black women will save us all and all that stuff. And black women, please teach us to be better white people. You know, you repackage it in a woke way or a disguised way, they just fall for it all over again. And they go right back to being flattered by the white validation. So, yeah, I mean, Moonlight to me missed me with that. I have no interest in it. I don't think it's even a good movie on a craft level. It's boring. All the characters are underdeveloped, undermotivated. And there's a lot of plot holes and things just make no sense. I just don't think it's even just a good movie on a craft level. I mean, forget the fact that it's just another white savior movie, except it's the sister type. It's called, you know, the black non-savior, you know? I mean, it's just not anything particularly great. And it's funny because my mom is not really in tune with all this stuff as I am. And I gave her Get Out. And she saw Moonlight on demand on her cable. She's retired. She watched both. And then she kind of saw Get Out and what it was about. And she was like, oh, this is a scary movie. I don't really like scary movies. And I was like, no, watch it. You're going to really enjoy it. So then she watched it and she really thanked me. She's like, oh my God, I never expected this movie to be this good, you know? And she was like, why am I not hearing more about how great this movie is? Like I heard stuff about it, made a lot of money, but this is just like a really brilliant movie. She was even reading articles about it, and she never really usually does stuff like that. She asked me to just print out and bring her anything that helps decode the movie. And inspired her to talk about a lot of social issues, and she was really, it really got her mental wheels turning. And then a week later, she was home and she saw Moonlight, and then she called me. And I think what's good with her is because she's not kind of immersed in that society and getting that hype, and because she's older, she's able to be a lot more honest, because she doesn't always understand what she's supposed to think, which I think is a danger for a lot of smart people. We get very connected to our social circles and our professional circles and get very conscious about virtue signaling and making sure that we like the right things and don't like, you know, we're very susceptible to that modern emperor's new clothes syndrome. So because she's not, like, you know, she called me, she goes, you know, did I get the right Moonlight? And I'm like, what do you mean? Like, there's only one. She goes, so the one where, like, you know, they just like walk around all day sad and just beating each other up, that's it? And I'm like, yeah, that's the right Moonlight. And she's like, yeah, this is the movie everybody was like, she just kept going on that she couldn't believe, like, this was the movie. And I was trying to explain to her, like, I was like, look, it's what white people want to see black people do, and it's what black people who want to be liked by white people want to do to impress those white people. And that's just how it goes. And, you know, I think she got it, but I mean, that's just the world we live in. Okay. I think that's enough for today. Hope everyone enjoyed this. I am going to be having more guests in the coming weeks. We have one lined up for next episode that I think, actually, no, two episodes from now, because the next episode is a bonus premium, and I don't want this guest to be a bonus premium. He's a very good guest. I want him to be free. But yeah, we're lining up a lot of guests, and the hosts will be more frequent. So yeah, I hope you'll enjoy that, and everyone take care, be good to yourselves, and be good to each other. Bye.
If I went to Israel, I don't think Israel would be the best place for me to be at this time, considering the view that most Jews have of Louis Farrakhan.
You go to Nigeria, which is, if not the most corrupt nation in Africa, and it is, it could be the most corrupt nation in the world, Minister Farrakhan.
Oh, now, Mr. Wallace.
It is the most corrupt nation that I have ever covered. I've been there 25 years ago, and I've been there as recently as last year.
Fine. So what? 35 years old. That's what that nation is. Now, here's America, 226 years old. You love democracy, but there in Africa, you're trying to force these people into a system of government that you just have accepted 30 years ago, black folk got the right to vote. You're not in any moral position to tell anybody how corrupt they are. You should be quiet and let those of us who know our people go there and help them get out of that condition. But America should keep her mouth shut wherever there's a corrupt regime, as much hell as America has raised on the earth. No, I will not allow America or you, Mr. Wallace, to condemn them as the most corrupt nation on earth, when you have spilled the blood of human beings. Has Nigeria dropped an atomic bomb and killed people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki? Have they killed off millions of Native Americans? How dare you put yourself in that position as a moral judge? I think you should keep quiet, because with that much blood on America's hands, you have no right to speak. I will speak, because I don't have that blood on my hands. Yes, there's corruption there. Yes, there's mismanagement of resources. Yes, there is abuse. There's abuse in every nation on earth, including this one. So let's not play holy to moralize on them. Let's help them.
I'm not moralizing. I'm asking a question, and I got an answer.
Why would you put it as the most corrupt regime in the world? That doesn't make sense.
Can you think of one more corrupt?
Yeah, I'm living in one. I'm living in one. Yes. You've done a hell of a thing on this earth, so you should not be the one to talk. You should be quiet when it comes to moral condemnation. In my judgment. I didn't mean to be so fiery.
No, that's good. That's good.
That's my passion.
Master Geo style. We zone now. That's his Geo style.
Hey, zone now, Geo style. Niggas wanna know how to flow now. Niggas wanna know how to show's pal. Niggas wanna know how to fold pals. Hey, get bread like toast style. All fresh, no old style. And look up that new cloud. Got new niggas doing bounce now. Taking back our old sound. Giving y'all our new shit. Tell Michigan we need millions. You know how we do this. Staying on that broke shit until I get a new wrist. And then buy these little diamonds that kill me on some stupid shit.
I know you want me to stay all night. And I wish I could too. Sneakers on my feet, stay on the move. Don't get attached like glue sticks. True shit, we do this. It's all on.